Hi everyone. All of us go through times that are challenging and stressful, and many suffer anxiety or panic or both. But what about top athletes, expected to be at their best always? But what about the pressures of training, competing, the media, and even injuries? Well, this show is all about not just being your best, but feeling your best, regardless of results. Welcome to Thrive, the podcast for high-performance athletes. We destigmatize the whole mental health and wellness subject, whilst bringing you tips from world-renowned experts of how to, well, thrive. Now today on the Thrive podcast, our guest is a leading expert on anxiety. Now of course we all get anxious to some degree, but sports people by the very nature get that familiar feeling of uneasiness, distress or dread. Why do we get it? And how can we deal with it effectively? Well, who better than our guest, Joshua Fletcher. Joshua is a leading expert a UK-based psychotherapist on dealing with conditions revolving around anxiety and panic disorders. Joshua, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to see you. And I'm looking forward to being on the Thrive podcast.
Well, we're very grateful to have you. I can tell you I've read some of your work and I've obviously listened to your podcast, but listen, Alon, as you know, is the former manager of a number of number one tennis players, things. And I want to ask you, Alon, you've obviously worked with number one tennis players and athletes. Can you give us an example of some of the contexts that you have seen personally? You've been a witness firsthand where you've seen players and athletes experience anxiety and panic.
Sure, I think there's many different situations, and also the way the anxiety expresses itself often is very hidden. For example, before big matches, I often see players become very nervous, very anxious, and they have different forms of coping mechanisms. I've seen players who literally become sick just before a big match, or who have a stomach issue, or who say they didn't sleep well, like already pre-framing like excuses for the match. Then I've seen players during matches like become extremely tense and their face getting really red, like almost like a fireball about to explode. And people from outside don't really see it, but when you know the players, you see the change in their physiology. We've recently heard more and more about players who had like breathing issues in the midst of matches that seem to be coming from nowhere. I've also seen players become very anxious off the tennis court, for example, before meeting a sponsor or speaking to the press. And then I would say one more category is when players have lost a few matches in a row, or they get injured, or they have some kind of setback that creates like a story in their mind: what if I'll never manage coming back to where I was before?
So that brings me on to the question, Joshua. Athletes, tennis players, whatever, in whichever sport, in fact, all high performers seem so mentally strong. How come they have these seemingly random, if you like, anxiety and panic attacks?
An anxiety and panic attack is first of all really important to understand what's actually happening. Nothing's actually attacking people. It's what happens is when we experience panic, we are experiencing a lot of adrenaline and cortisol that have suddenly been dumped and released into our system. And that happens because the brain gets confused and thinks we're under threat. Now, if you take high-performance athletes who push themselves to the limit physically and mentally, and when they don't balance that with rest and compassion, what happens is the primitive part of our brain, the lizard part of our brain, misinterprets that stress as danger. And so what it will do is that, well, it'll try to look after you. So go, well, you seem really, really, really stressed. So just in case you're in danger, I'm going to release a lot of adrenaline and a lot of cortisol, but when you don't expect it. Now, you can understand the adrenaline and the cortisol before a big match or a big event, and you don't really question it. But panic ensues when it triggers when you don't expect it. And that's basically what a panic attack is. It's when a lot of stress happens all at once. It always builds. What I hear a lot is, oh, I was hit by a panic attack from nowhere. It's like, well, if you look back at your last 2-3 weeks, months even, it didn't really come nowhere, did it? This was building for a while. And that part of the brain just tries to look after you. And it doesn't surprise me at all that top-level athletes suddenly experience panic. Maybe they've pushed themselves to the absolute limit in preparation for the match. And then during the match, the brain is going, this is an enormous amount of stress. I'm going to give you lots and lots of adrenaline now. And you know it's panic because you struggle to catch your breath. Like Alan was saying before, your breathing goes. You tense up. You're not as kind of flexible. Your heart starts to race and palpitate. You start to dissociate, which is a really scary symptom where you just feel not real. You feel like you're in a dream. It's called derealization, dissociation. That's a really big symptom of panic. And you feel this sudden whoosh, like something awful's about to happen. So that's what happens when you panic. With panic, it's the brain, the other side of your brain, not your mammal brain, but the lizard part of your brain, just goes, hey, are you in danger? Well, just in case, have a week's worth of adrenaline right now, just in case. And yeah, it catches a lot of people off guard. It can be very scary. I know I've experienced a lot. I was diagnosed with panic disorder and had panic attacks a lot. But yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all that people experience them, particularly in the field of tennis.
Wow, that was really a lot and very interesting. And like the one thing that I took from what you said is that the panic attack itself, like it seems like it comes from nowhere, but it was in the making sometime before.
Absolutely. And
can you go a bit deeper? What do you mean with that? And like related to an athlete, like hypothetically, how that could build up?
Absolutely. So this is what I use with everyone, but it's particularly helpful for athletes and people in high stress, physical stress jobs and stuff. Someone asked me, you know, where does intense anxiety and panic attacks come from? Why? Why does it happen to me? And I use a simple analogy. I call it the jug analogy. Now, the jug is our stress jug. It's our ability to tolerate stress. Now, the size of that jug depends on things like genetics. So if your mom and dad are anxious or have mental health issues, then your tolerance for stress will be lower. Does it make you weak? Doesn't make you anything. It's just genetics that you don't choose that. My tolerance to stress is quite low, so I've got to be careful what goes into my stress jug. And we can tolerate a lot of stress as humans. We're excellent at tolerating stress. But if you imagine the stress jug and it's slowly kind of filling up a little bit at a time with different stresses, that's fine. We can deal with that. So you could have everyday stresses like relationship stress. Perhaps there's stress about your performance and in playing recently. Perhaps there's stress about, you know, there's physical stress and your preparation for matches. Perhaps you've picked up an injury and the stress of trying to get fit before the tournament is there. Maybe you're stressed because a family member is unwell. Maybe you're stressed because you were in a car accident. Maybe you're stressed because you grew up in an abusive home and you never dealt with it. This builds up and up and up. Then, as all the major athletes do. You've got the stress of pushing yourself, discipline. Yes, it's needed and it's essential, but it's also stressful. Then you've got positive stress, like I've just moved house. Actually, I'm celebrating just winning the latest match. Actually, I've just had a child. This keeps building and building and building. Positive stress, negative stress. It just builds, 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 builds. When we don't have a balancing output for that, i.e. rest, a compassionate voice inside us to go, you know what, you're allowed to just stop this evening. You need to rest mentally and physically. When we go through something really stressful, as well as playing in tournaments, we can start flying around the world, et cetera, et cetera. What happens is that this becomes full. And it becomes full at that moment that you don't expect it, where it feels like it's come from nowhere. And that's where it happens. And I have never, ever met someone who has come sat in my practice. And I've worked with tennis players in the past. I've worked with lots of sports people and musicians. When you look back and when they struggle with panic, you'll find is that their stress jug is overflowing. And you'll go through it and you'll be like, oh, I've been through a hell of a lot recently. And so, yeah. But unfortunately, the narrative is that we treat the panic attacks. So, no. Your panic attacks are warning you about something. You know, it's saying this isn't sustainable. This level of stress is not sustainable. And so what I do as a therapist is to teach people, listen, what can we take out of that jug? You don't need to empty it all. You need it. You know, if you need to train hard for your match, that's going to stay in there. If you're you know, stressed and nervous about your match, that's normal. It's human. But if there's other things like, you know, you're having problems at home or there's stuff that you've not dealt with in the past, which we all do. We all have stuff that we don't deal with necessarily. My aim is to just free up more room in the jug. And that's what I do successfully with lots of people from all walks of life. But particularly, you know, you've got to be careful if your job, i.e. playing tennis, is stressful.
Can I ask, Joshua, what you're saying is that stress jug, be it positive or negative, is all in the same, it all adds up. So if you win lots of tournaments, the stress jug, if you like, fills up. So what are the tools that you offer or advise to bring that stress jug down? And I presume if the stress jug becomes, or bottle, stress bottle becomes overfilled, that's when the likelihood is of panic or anxiety attacks ensues. And therefore, you need to deal with it earlier and look at the stress bottle and say, now, come on, Joshua, come on, Alon, we need to bring that level down. How do you do that? And how do you know when it's time to bring it down?
Well, you know it's time to bring it down when you start to feel the physical symptoms of anxiety. Albeit you feel your mind and body will warn you. You'll feel stressed. You feel irritated. Maybe you'll have angry outbursts. Maybe you're not sleeping properly. Maybe you fear anxiety itself. Maybe one of the main things that fills your stress jug bowl is the fear of fear. So when people have panic attacks and they find it quite embarrassing or they find it quite debilitating and scary, what they'll do is they'll begin to fear panic. So they'll start to avoid doing things like, oh, I don't do that just in case I panic again, or I don't do that just in case I panic. And they become very superstitious. That fills up the jug. Tip number one is to find out what's in yours. What's going on in your life that's happening that, you know, if I sit here with clients having panic attacks, I'll be like, oh, what's going on? Where's your stress coming from? And that's what we look at. Also teach people that, you know, panic attacks are not dangerous. They're not hurting you. See it actually as a positive. I think too many people see it as a negative. They're like, oh, having panic attacks, I'm doing something wrong. Well, actually, no, that there's too much on, you know. What athletes got to realize as well, if you're looking at it from a physiological point of view, is that you've got to look at the nervous system. So your nervous system, your involuntary nervous system, is split into two. You've got your sympathetic nervous system, and that's responsible for stress and panic. So if you're having a panic attack, that's your sympathetic nervous system. If you're really stressed and you're running on adrenaline to get stuff done, chasing to-do lists, meeting targets. That's your sympathetic nervous system. And it's great, good part of our nervous system. But people often forget and neglect the other side of our nervous system, which is the parasympathetic nervous system. And that is activated when we rest and digest. So when you're chilling out, having a laugh, spending time with friends and family, having a nice bath, whatever, and you're not constantly thinking of the next thing, that's your parasympathetic nervous system. So if you catch yourself relaxing and laughing, that is so important. You know, you can forcefully activate the parasympathetic nervous system. People do it all the time, like they have ice baths and things like that. That forces the parasympathetic nervous system. But it's honestly a lot better when you kind of allow yourself and give yourself permission to rest. And I've done that as well with people I work with. It's like, no, how much of this is you giving yourself permission to rest? Because you'll find that that is still stress that goes in the jug. So see it as a balancing of that nervous system. It's so important. I'm someone many years ago used to just push it and 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 push it. And then I'm wondering why I'm stood in a supermarket dissociating, having panic attacks. There's no surprise there. Also as well, it's really good. Another way to activate the parasympathetic nervous system is things like ongoing counseling and stuff. People see counseling as something like a weakness, or I have to go to counseling because I'm rock bottom. No, you don't. You know, I still go to counseling now, and I'm a highly successful author, therapist myself. It's just something that prevents the jug from filling up. Also, I've been through a lot of stuff in my life, and you'll find that a lot of people, no matter what they do, go through a lot of stuff, and it's okay to talk about it. For me personally, it's grief, you know, and grief doesn't just go away because you spoke about it once. It stays there. And I know personally, grief can fill up the jug. Either way, we've got to stop looking at whacking the panic attacks on the head. It's preventative. Don't stop. Don't just paint over the cracks.
Amazing. Joshua, one other question. Like, I understand how the jug works and how often we do so many things and like we overload ourselves and the jug overflows. With athletes, one thing I do see is how they're thinking, and they're thinking about expectations and what might happen if they don't fulfill those expectations, and literally feeling threatened about like a projected future is what causes a lot of anxiety. So my question, to what extent is anxiety coming from our thinking? Or to what extent can anxiety really come from our thinking, even if maybe like we've sorted out our life and we're not like overwhelmed with too many things?
Yeah, brilliant. So we're going to remember is anxiety is the mind's threat response. And for our ancestors, it was fantastic. You know, if you a threat to our ancestors with things like lions and tigers and hyenas and things. And it was one of the most powerful things that the humans have evolved to make us the most powerful predators ever in existence. Not because we're strong, because we're not, and we're not really well equipped to deal with many things, but we have a mechanism where we can anticipate threat, not just react to threat, anticipate threat. That's what made humans so strong. And you're probably thinking, what's this got to do with tennis players? And I'll explain to you why in a second. It was so remarkable for humans thousands of years ago to walk, say, through the jungle, through the desert, and spot a pride of lions from a mile away, because then we could hide, we could sneak up on them, we can plan. And that was amazing. What an amazing mechanism to have in our brain to sense threat before it even comes. We kind of copied the meerkat in that sense. The meerkat's a really clever animal. You know, just it will just anticipate threat all day. And we're really good at doing that. And it was wonderful for our ancestors. Brilliant. We could evolve, do things like that. That very same mechanism in our brain has never evolved. It's still there. But the only thing that's changed is what our interpretation and definition of a threat is. Now, we live in a relatively safe society, you know, and so tennis players don't have to worry about saber-toothed tigers jumping out and eating them. But what they do realize is that the threat has become our esteem. The threat has become our identity. The threat has become, who am I if I don't win? And when we put our entire identity and our esteem on such a 50-50 outcome, like a tennis match, whew, no wonder your threat response is going to go absolutely bananas, because the stakes are so high. You know, obviously you've got to get the right balance between, you know, you want to win, you're an athlete. Athletes want to win, and they should win if they want to keep being athletes. But it's the difference between, is this everything of who I am on this match? And that's what I work with. I've worked with people, I work with like boxers and things as well. And they say to me, is this everything you are? And understanding that, yeah, your thoughts will interpret the actual match as a threat, as well as the sport that you love playing. And so it's a bit like, well, I often work with people and I'll say, listen, is this a threat? Why is this a threat? You know, you want to win, you want to be anxious, that's okay. Anxiety is performance enhancing to an extent. But if everything relies on this moment, then that is a lot of pressure to put on yourself, like holistically, as a human being. This is me. And if I fail, I have failed as a human being. No wonder your threat response, the same threat response that your ancestors had, is going wild. You know, and that's why, and I see that a lot. It's how are you measuring yourself? You know, and I think, you know, I ask people, that's where we can't forget to treat people as humans as well as tennis players. I am a human and I play tennis and I'm good at it, rather than all I am is a tennis player, if that makes sense.
What it appears to me, Joshua, is that there is a kind of confusion between identity, your self-identity, and, you know, I guess, if you like, your identity crossing over to what you want in terms of your performance. Now, I don't know. Alon knows more than me in this instance, but all the top players would need that kind of element, because some people will go for the victory because they don't want to lose, whereas some will go for it because they want to win. And therefore, I guess that identity thing kind of confuses that aim for competing. And that comes with a balance. How do you advise those athletes in that respect? How do you advise them in terms of getting that balance right, why you want to win?
That's really good. I like the difference between because I want to win and because I don't want to lose. I really like that. There's a word I use in humanistic psychology, and if there's something you can take away from this, I love using this word. When I found out about it myself, I spent weeks just reflecting on it, still do. There's a word in humanistic psychology called introjection. Not interjection, like being rude and annoying someone, like introjection. And that is when we infer a belief or absorb a belief from something, like an event. So for example, and this is really important, and this is for everyone, if you're struggling with anxiety and panic and an identity and esteem issues, and you want to answer that question that Keith just said, like, well, how do I discern? Each person's relationship is different because of these introjections. For example, you know, if you grew up in a tennis family and you only ever got praise for being good at tennis, you would introject a belief that I only have value when I win at tennis. If you're never praised for anything else, like not doing well, you know, doing well at school, being polite, having nice manners, being kind, empathetic, being funny, doing all these things, that doesn't matter, because if, and this is why counselors and therapists love poking about in your childhood, is because you introject that belief about yourself. And you've got micro introjections and mass scale introjections. One of the most common introjections is boys don't cry. You know, some people are taught that by idiots growing up. And it's a bit like, you know, or don't cry, be strong. Well, that's an interjection that's been passed down through generations. So, you know, if I hear that, I'm going to interject, oh, well, then showing emotion is a weakness. You know, and but why? That's just learned. Like, who decided that? Just because my granddad said it. Well, my granddad spoke nonsense. You know, and so it's a bit like, what did you interject? You know, if I come home from school as a kid, you know, and I'm good at art, my parents are like, I'm not really bothered. I might interject that I'm not very interesting and my passions aren't very interesting. But let's say my sister came home and, you know, got praised for winning a football match. Then I might interject that to have value, I must be sporty, you know, and suddenly I'll then start to go into sport for the wrong reasons, you know, and I start to do it because I don't enjoy it. I just do it because I want to have that value, that identity. You interject lessons all the time, everywhere, whether it's school around you, whether you're a person of faith, whether it's in society. Social media is a massive one. The news, cultural things about gender, who you are. You are an accumulation of your interjections. Now, a lot of them are cool and healthy. You know, I remember at school, I'd interject, you know, it's good to be kind. It's good to have manners. It's good to do all these things. I like that interjection. But sometimes you might interject some really unhelpful narratives. And if it is something like, I only have value when I win at tennis, rather than I really enjoy winning at tennis. You know, that's so important. I'll share one of my own, just to give you an example that I work through. And you can change these interjections. I used to do stand-up comedy a lot. And I really enjoy making people laugh. And when I work through these interjections in my own personal therapy, I found that actually when I was younger, the only way to get anything positively emotional out of my father was to make him laugh. He was a kind of reserved guy, loved him to bits, but he didn't really show much. Now, to a kid, when you see someone's face light up and you influence that, I interjected a lesson that, well, in order to have value, it's important to make people laugh. So guess what? I became the class clown. I'd made everyone laugh. I loved it. It was like a drug. I go do that all the way through school, college, university. And I still like making people laugh now. But it used to become a problem. Like if I did a stand-up gig and no one laughed or whatever, I'd have panic attacks, depression. I'd make my whole life about trying to make people laugh. And it's because I interjected from a very young age that it's really important. But it's not really important. It's a bonus. It's not really important if people find you funny or not, you know. And that, for me, is just an example of an interjected belief that I changed. And you'll find that all prejudices are interjected. Someone told you that prejudice, and you just like, right, I'll believe that. You know, and there's all these things. And you find a lot of people are harsh on themselves. A lot of people that constantly say, I should, I should, I should, I should. People who feel guilty for resting and all that, they have a lot of interjected beliefs that they don't challenge because they take it as the status quo and don't. As a therapist, as someone who's been anxious, you can challenge them. And you'll probably rediscover your love for tennis even more when you do it for you, not for someone else.
What do you think some of the most common interjections are that athletes have who struggle with mental wellness?
Excellent. Overly harsh parents. You know, like, I've heard it and I've seen it. I call it touchline dad syndrome. That's a joke that I call it. You know, I remember as a kid, played with my friends, and the dad was, this was football, and my dad was just there like, why didn't you do that? You're useless. And they played not to lose, like Keith said before. They played not to lose because their motivation was to not be criticized. You know, being harsh, overly harsh parents. Now, there is an argument there. Like, if you want to push someone to the limit to be the best, you've got to be a bit harsh sometimes. You know, if you want to be the best tennis player, there's a level of intense discipline. If you look at the best in any sport, they have been pushed to the limit. And there's an argument for that. But I always think there's a room for balance. And it's just, yeah, people that just do it to avoid criticism because they've just grown up in a really intense environment where they're just constantly baited for not being good enough. You know, whereas I think it's different when you've got like people raised with constructive criticism. They're the best coaches and managers where they go, listen, you know, your forehand today was not great. However, your movement at the back, sorry, I'm not a tennis player, but your movement was outstanding. And so you're giving someone something to contemplate, like, what can I do better? But also, I have value. My effort was acknowledged. I find that gets the best out of people. And you see that a lot now in sport. There's an evolution of how you manage people. And yeah, it's that. But the most common interjection is, if I don't win, I don't have value as a person.
Could it be possible that if you try and change those learnt beliefs about why you play the game, you could have potentially players, athletes, in whatever sport, revising or think to themselves, actually, I don't have the same intensity. So how do you actually get that balance right between however you've been motivated before into continuous motivation without that pressure?
Yeah, I think the vast majority of athletes, it's true, it's possible, but I don't think, you know, I think people who play tennis in particular do it because they do enjoy it, you know, and they'll get, you know, it will be part of their identity. It's very rare that you hear someone say like, oh, I only do this for my really harsh mother or father. Oh, I'm putting down the racket and welcoming. I mean, that's very rare. But what you do find actually is that I find the opposite happens. I find that when you place a sport for you, they start to love it a bit more. I find it, I don't know about tennis, but I know in other sports, you hear the common cliche like, oh, no, you know, in football, so he's playing like he loves it out there, or golf. You know, he's playing it with a smile on his face, you know, because they're just really enjoying it. And actually, they play better because they're enjoying it. And I don't know how it works in there. But yeah, it's possible, you know, that no one should be forced to do what they want to do. But, you know, I think the vast majority of people that would like, would be like, okay, it might be easier if I go in with less pressure on myself and start enjoying it more. I'm doing this because I want to win for me, as opposed to silence an inner critic that I have in myself and others. I think it goes the other way, Keith, actually. When you lift the pressure off, I find that most people actually find that they enjoy it more, as opposed to, you know, I'm doing this for me now. You know, yeah, it's very, very rare that it's resented as a result of that. I think it's more of their association with the sport is more positive. You know, if you've got really harsh, you know, growing up in a really harsh environment or a really harsh coach or really harsh or whatever, when you start to reclaim ownership again over that, you know, you're lighter on your feet, you know, and things like that. But yeah, that's how I see it.
I have a question, and you can use boxing for this since you work with boxers.
Mm.
Let's say your client has a big boxing fight. And he suffered from anxiety in the past. What's the best way to spend like the last hour before the match, before the boxing fight, apart from the warm-up and all of that? Like, let's say he has 20 minutes to just chill and relax. What would you recommend him to do?
It's a different one, because in boxing, you've got to rile yourself up, don't you? It's good to get the adrenaline pumping. It's because it's actually a pain nullifier as well. If your anxiety is pumping, you can't feel the punches. Yeah, really interesting. For me, it's more in the build-up, as in like the longer build-up. What you do on game day is like everyone has their own thing, you know. But for me, I want to make sure that their life before it is good. When you take someone like Tyson Fury, you know, who's well documented struggles with anxiety and depression, and he's heavyweight champ of the world, what he'll do is actually he'll spend time with his family a lot before he goes to camp. you know, because he knows he's going to spend a long time with them. And then immediately after the fight, he spends time with his family and he chills out and he steps out of the boxing world for a little bit, you know. So, yeah, you and they, going back to that nervous system thing, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, you're allowed, you know, running on adrenaline is great and you'll need that and you will use all of your resources, whether it's a tennis match or a boxing match or whatever. And you do whatever you do to psych yourself up, that's okay. You can use anger if you want. You can use positivity. Each person's different. You know, some people get really psyched up. And you can do, use whatever, but make sure that it's cushioned beforehand with some rest and digest and stuff. So then you can utilize all your resources and then make sure you rest mentally and physically afterwards. But if it's an hour before a match, you know, I it's usually me asking, what do you do? You know, what do you do? If you're struggling with anxiety, good, good. You're anxious because you care. Good. It's a superpower. You've got adrenaline and cortisol. You are fired up. I know you might feel a bit sick. That's good. You know, it's okay. I know you might feel all that. That's all right. You are primed in top condition to play this match. If you stroll up relaxed, yawning, like, oh, you know, let's hit a few balls. Why not? You're not going to get the best out of yourself, are you? You know, and that's where it's different in sport. You know, it's great when I work with non-athletes, like, you know, go do your presentation, you know, whatever. Chill out. You can do that. But no, you use anxiety as your superpower to help you because it is, you know, scientifically proven to be performance enhancing. Obviously, when you're having panic and adrenaline floods, it's, you know, it's a bit too much. But yeah, in the hour, do what works for you. It's okay. You know, what works for you.
Yeah, just one more scenario. Like, let's say a different sport, like, and the athlete finishes his match or his competition, and now he has to talk to the press. And she feels very anxious about press, or he feels very anxious. But it's something they have to do. It's part of their job description. How would you help them? You have 5 minutes before they walk into a room full of journalists. They're anxious like hell. What can they do?
I'm glad you asked this because I know this was actually, you know, in the media not so long ago, was it, about like not wanting to do these interviews stuff. First of all, I'd say it's your threat response will be going off because of judgment. You know, it's very hard, difficult to shift from being judged as a tennis player to then being judged as a human. What I'd say, it's absolutely okay. It's not, the performance stops, you know. You're performing and playing tennis. And that's why people come to see you. And if you've got obligatory media requirements, it's okay to say to yourself, the performance has stopped now. You can just say your answers. You don't need to start, you know, doing, you know, juggling and entertaining. If you want to, that's great. But just know that your entire being is not judged by what you say to that press panel or whatever it is that you do. If you say something silly, it's all right. You know, you're not going to get your words out okay. You know, and just know that it's not weakness if you're anxious in front of the cameras. Anyone would find that anxiety inducing. It doesn't matter how many times you've been through it. No, my advice also to you is would be to actually talk about it in a private space with a trained therapist and explore why your brain interprets that judgment as a threat. And what you'll find there is that you'll find introjected lessons. I usually find this anyway. Also, it's just okay. Like, if you just don't like it, you don't like it. You know, I think we all have parts of our job that we just don't like. You know, okay, this high, you can feel like a high amount of pressure there, but take it off. You know, you've just played a grueling tennis match, you know, showing off your skills. That was the hard thing. And if you just need to answer some questions, you can do it. Anxious or not, you can do it, you know, and that's what I would, that's what my advice would be to some of them, and explore why judgment is a threat to you. It's okay. You know, it's not weakness. Honestly, I've worked with so many high achieving individuals across sport, across the creative arts. Obviously I can't say who I've worked with, but it's so common. You know, you're not weak. There's nothing wrong with you for experiencing that.
So what you're saying, Joshua, is that some of those messages, if you like, about judgment or whatever it may be about why you want to win, You're saying these can be unlearned. A bit like you can train to become less anxious. Because I was told by a therapist in a different genre that some of your beliefs that have been learned through messages that we've talked about from childhood or whatever, validation, having those removed is a bit like having open heart surgery. So, but from what you're saying is you can train yourself to change those messages internally and therefore lighten the load. And you're saying that you can effectively train to become less anxious. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Our brains are incredibly neuroplastic. I mean, as you two, as sports people, how many times have you, how many years did you have a particular stroke and but then you had to change it? You change it slightly. You know, I play golf and I spent 10 years hitting the ball a certain way. It was automatic. And then I changed it slightly because my brain is incredibly neuroplastic. Yes, you can with repetition, with commitment, etc. I don't agree with the it's like open heart surgery thing. I think that's a bit hyperbolic. If you want to change it, you can. You know, there's some things that are like I'd like to keep. You know, I quite like elements of masculinity. You know, a certain traits of masculinity I think should be celebrated, and some traits that shouldn't be and are quite toxic. And so it's a bit like, what you choose is important. If you choose to be like, you know what, I want to not care what people think when I'm being interviewed, you can definitely rewire the brain to do that. Yeah. But you're not fundamentally changing who you are. You can change, you can pick traits if you'd like, because your brain's so neuroplastic. You can change, if you really wanted to, you could change your default language. It happens all the time. People grow up in one country, they move to another country, and their default language changes. The literal language of their thinking changes because of commitment and repetition. Lots of commitment and repetition if you want to change it. You know, in therapy, you open up Pandora's box, you see what's in there, and it's like, well, actually, I find that quite hindering, that belief. So, I would like to change that belief a little bit at a time. You don't need to change 15 beliefs at once. You just can't do that anyway. But a little bit at a time. So, yeah, if you find you have a hindering belief, you can change that, yeah. It doesn't happen immediately. It takes acceptance and commitment to wanting to change it. I've done it personally loads, absolutely loads. I've done it with beliefs of myself and just general beliefs about other things. I've challenged my own internal prejudices that I've had, you know, which is really, you know, a powerful thing to do. But yeah, you can do it, but it's something you have to want to do. And I think that's nice. You know, you're not opening up your brain and then suddenly, you know, changing who you are. But you can, if you want to, commit to it.
So in a way, actually, if we really think about it, you mentioned neuroplasticity, you mentioned the word change, and athletes, through the span of a career, the competition changes, their opponents change, they usually have to improve and get better and develop their skills. And at some level, I guess, they have to embrace uncertainty. They don't know what will happen when they compete in a match. It's 50-50, as you said. They don't know what will happen in a year. They don't know what happens in 5 years. So in a way, you become less anxious when you embrace the idea of being able to change, being able to cope with new situations. Am I hearing and understanding that correctly?
Absolutely, yeah. When I work with all forms of anxiety, the one sentence that applies to all anxious recovery or wellness is practicing your skill of the willful tolerance of uncertainty. Yeah. No one likes uncertainty, really. Well, they do in some extent, but no one likes it when it comes to like the threat. Your threat response hates uncertainty. That very same mechanism that makes us the most powerful predator in the world doesn't like uncertainty, so it can fixate on it. But that isn't just our brain. Our brains are enormous. There's many things that we can do. The willful tolerance of uncertainty is a skill. I still practice it. And also reminding ourselves that uncertainty is what makes things like beautiful. If everything was certain, how dull would life be? It wouldn't really exist. The willful tolerance of uncertainty, whether it's panic attacks, whether it's judging your esteem on something, whether it's, you know, going into a match, that's okay. It's why you kind of play the sport, surely. You know, it would be boring. You wouldn't get up in the morning knowing that every match you play, you win. You play because there's a thrill not knowing that you can win. So use that as well. And people like the anxious thrill as well. I love the anxious thrill of doing things. Like, you know, I'll do talks in front of loads of people. It's terrifying. I'm still scared of it, but I do it because I'm willfully tolerating it. You're not going to enjoy it. I always say willful tolerance, you know, willfully tolerate it. That's the difference between doing an interview with loads of press. The people who do it for years but hate it, you're tolerating it. Now just add a willful in front of it. Now I'm going to willingly go and tolerate uncertainty there. And it's so powerful.
Listen, Joshua, I know we're coming to the end. There's one or two questions that I think myself and Anna would like to ask you. And one of them is, we often see on football matches, boxing matches, tennis matches, a trainer come on, or not necessarily a trainer, physio, because you got an injury. Now, in the world of mental health, we often say, oh, well, you can see where you got to put a Band-Aid or a plaster over something. But in a mental situation, you can't. You don't know what goes on in between people's ears. If you were called on to a football pitch, a tennis court, where a player, like Emma Raducanu, I believe, had last year at Wimbledon, I think she had some sort of panic attack, and you had a few minutes to sort of, you know, put the cold sponge on her, what have you, how would you deal with it?
It's a great question. I ground them in the present. I'd be like, you know, look at me in the eyes. You're a human. I'm human. About 2 minutes here. You're breathing fine. You're okay. You know, your body's just doing what it's doing. It's okay. You don't need to get involved. Just take 2 minutes. Get out of your head and into here for a second. You know, really good for your parasympathetic nervous system. I'm quite bizarre. I'd go on and just ask them a completely bizarre question, just to take them out of where they are for a second. They might be in front of loads, thousands of people watching them. And I'd be like, what's your favorite dessert? I'm like, what? No, tell me your favorite dessert. Why? No, and you've just snapped yourself out of a habit. The brain's going, what? And the confusion of that actually alleviates stress. Because I said before, our brain is really neuroplastic. When you break the cycle of certain thoughts and patterns, that helps. Yeah, I'd go on and do something like that. I'd ask them, you know, you're safe. You're okay. It's okay to feel stressed. There's no shame in needing to talk. And I'll help you. Just come out of that sphere for a couple of minutes. You know, if they want to talk, I'd be like, what are you feeling? What are you worried about? Yeah. And then I'd take them away from the sec, just mentally for a bit. You know, some people use different things like positive visualization and all that. So that never really worked for me. You know, imagine yourself on a beach. I'm not on a beach. I'm in front of thousands of people. Yeah. If that works for you, that's great. But for me, it's just I just blindside them with silly questions. But knowing, and we've agreed before, you answer my questions. And it is bizarre. And I challenge you, next time you're really stressed or whatever, get someone to ask you a bizarre question, like, where's your favorite place to go on holiday? And then check in on how you feel afterwards, because your focus was taken away from the stressful thing that kept releasing cortisol, that kept releasing adrenaline, that kept the tension going. Yeah, that's why I do. I've never been asked to do that, you know.
Maybe after this interview, we'll have people asking you.
Just a big 6'2" Northern British guy running on like, what's your favorite ice cream? What? That's not helpful. There we go. But no, that's what I would do. Yeah, I do. Little, awesome. a very spontaneous and things like that. Yeah.
Joshua, before we ask you the last, ask you the last question, sorry, Keith. If people want to learn more about you or get in touch with you, where can they find you?
So I go under the name Anxiety Josh. I do most of my work on like Instagram and things. I've actually spoken to several tennis players on there, actually, which is really nice. Yeah, Anxiety Josh, Joshua Fletcher, just bang it in Google, and you'll see things that what I do there. I've got podcasts and stuff. If you suffer from panic and acute anxiety or know someone who does, you know, there's loads of information there if you want to check it out. Yeah, Anxiety Josh, finally, or at Anxiety Josh on social media.
Great. Final question. Any final thoughts, comments to the world of sports with regards to what they can do when they feel anxious or have panic attacks?
Yeah. You are an excellent person who plays tennis, as opposed to you're not only a tennis player. That's what I'd say if this is going out to the tennis world. And I'd say if you're having panic attacks, it's just adrenaline. It's just adrenaline at a time where I don't really want it. You know, it's not hurting me. I am safe. Absolutely, you can do that. Yeah, that's what I would say to people struggling with panic. Remember, your jug is overflowing. It's okay to explore what's in it. You're not going to empty all of your jug, but let's get rid of the stuff that doesn't need to be in there. And you're not broken. You don't need to be fixed. Just things need to be put in the right order again. You're in no way weak. Anxiety is literally a threat response. It is literally fear. And if you face every day with that fear, the definition of that is courage and strength. And I win because my definitions are factual.
Well, listen, Joshua, you've been really interesting and engaging, and I'm sure that the audience will learn a lot from your messages. We want to, obviously, on behalf of myself and Alon, and of course the Thrive Project, we wanted to thank you very much for taking your time out today and being with us, and I'm sure the audience will gain tremendous benefit from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alon, and thank you, Keith. And wish you the best.
Do head over to the Thrive website. That's www.thrive, spelt THR, the digit one, VE.space, where you can sign up for further giveaways and, of course, tips. That's www.thrive, spelt THR, one, VE.space. After all, this is your space to thrive.